go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. You're you. We are joined, of course, with our fantastic production team of super producers, Dylan Fagan and Noel Brown. This is the second part of a two-part episode. So if you are just now tuning in, you probably want to pause for a second and check out the first part of this series. We'll wait.
Well, that's not way too long, really. I mean, I think that something could be done, you know, outside of us just waiting another hour for them to go listen to another episode, right?
No, we're going to sit here and wait for an hour.
All right, let's do it. I can't take it any longer.
thanks to the magic of editing.
Yeah, I just can't take it. We got to continue on with the story because there's a lot more to tell. We've only made it through about 1920 with
yes.
this guy. Now, as we said, 1921 was kind of a breakthrough year for him in oval track racing, and mm-hmm. this is a big deal for Harry Miller. And one thing that I wanted to mention here that we missed in episode one, and I didn't exactly know when it happened, but I went back and checked and found out that a character involved in his life that we kind of glossed over early on was Ollie Evinrude. And we said that their paths would cross.
Right.
Well, they did, but it was back in 1907 or earlier than 1907. So, much, much earlier than, you know, we are right now. This is kind of weird. This is how history works, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. you get a couple of different, versions of what's going on. One version says that these two guys worked together. You know, they were coworkers. Another version says that they were neighbors, and that's how they found, you know, mm-hmm. kind of found each other. Truth be known, they were both in the Wisconsin area at the time, and they both had an interest in things mechanical. And I guess Ollie got wind of what Harry Miller was up to with his engines, because he was putting, I guess he called it a stationary engine, maybe engines into boats, really.
Yes.
But he was also working on an early version, I guess, of an outboard engine. So something that, you know, could be moved from one vehicle to the next, mm-hmm. one boat to the next. And Evinrude got wind of this and liked the idea. The problem was that the Harry Miller version was a four-cylinder outboard motor. And Evinrude thought, well, I can perfect that. And he ended up taking two cylinders off of it and then patenting the two-cylinder design. And that's where the Evinrude outboard motor came from, all the way back in 1907, because these guys had, again, crossed paths. And, you know, that's just one of those things. Like, these two giants of – it's time, giants of – can you call them giants of industry?
I think at this point they're really tall people of industry at 1907.
How about entrepreneurs and businessmen?
Like up-and-comers.
Successful businessmen.
Yes.
But at that time, in 1907, neither one of them were really, you know – they hadn't really made it yet at that point.
Yeah, they hadn't they hadn't reached their full potential.
No, but if you fast forward, you know, 12, 13 years to the point we are now with Harry Miller, he had definitely made it. Again, the 1920s was a huge decade for him, and we just talked at the end of the last episode about the patent that he had filed for his TNT car.
Yes.
It had that 183 cubic inch four-cylinder engine, and had a lot of striking design characteristics that others copied and emulated throughout the next couple of decades, really. And I think we should mention this now. 1920 was big for him with design and building the entire vehicle, right? Like the whole package.
That's a really great point.
And so every single part of this car. Now, oh, you know what? Man, I'm crazy with my notes here. I'm going all over the place because I got so much. Every single part of this car at this point, mm-hmm. every single part of a Miller was something that he created himself. He created in the machine shop that he owned and operated. So he had gotten away from using production car parts in race cars, which up until that point had been the main idea.
Yeah,
behind
common
racing.
Practice.
Yeah, it's very common. You would perfect things. You know, you would change a few things here and there. But for the most part, you were using production car parts mm-hmm. in your race car. He completely changed that. He built – or almost every single part of the Miller car was always made in his own plant. And I mean, every part, you know, the every single little part of that car, there was an engineering drawing behind it. So it was a blueprinted car completely throughout, early on. Again, as early as 1920, and it took a long time to build these cars.
Yeah, we're talking about 6,000 to 6,500 man hours to build a complete car. And of that number, between 700 and 1,000 hours went into just putting the finishing touch on each machine, just beautifying.
Can you believe that? 6,000 to 6,500 man hours to build one race car. Now, I kind of get it. You know, it's 1920. I think they do it a lot faster now, even, but that's still a huge, huge number. Again, 1,000 hours just kind of refining each machine. That's a lot of time refining those machines. But here's the level of detail that this guy would go to. There's another note, again, going back in my notes, but there was an article here, a paragraph here early on that says that he took so much time and consideration into building these cars that every bit of metalwork and machinery that went into these vehicles, that it was completely beyond all practical consideration. Like he didn't care how much time it took. He didn't care how much it cost to develop that part. He wanted it perfect. And he said that, or it was said that, parts of these machines that would never, ever see the eyes of the public, you know, like something that was hidden deep down inside these race cars, was like crafted and formed and finished with just like the most loving care you could imagine. Like it was just the perfect part for the perfect place. Mm. And every single thing like that. He said, you know, no one would see this outside of the mechanics that tore these things down, but he took the time to really craft his cars right down to this granular level. And, you know, that idea, that dedication, you know, that artistic, a noble calling maybe, was something that a lot of other engineers and designers were attracted to, and they wanted to work for him. So he became working in his shop became something that was sought after. You know, a lot of people wanted to work with him and wanted to kind of learn his ways, maybe. You know, become apprentice to his master.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that reminds me in many ways of the practice we talked about in previous episodes of people at an auto plant or auto manufacturers themselves occasionally leaving Easter eggs for mechanics, like just some like initials or something.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Or maybe stowing something inside door panels that are never to be seen again.
Yeah.
Know, things that rattle, or maybe, you know, sometimes it's a joke. Sometimes it's a message, like you said, or sometimes it's an item. They'll throw an item in there, kind of a funny item sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
It happens.
I don't think he was doing that, but boy, it sounds like it would be a cool thing.
Well, he definitely wasn't doing that. He was more just focused on the precision of the machine and every single little part. It was almost like a watchmaker or something. You know, like every part has to be exactly perfect. Otherwise, the overall thing doesn't work.
But there's an argument to this too, man.
What's
that? The argument here, which I support, by the way, is that if you want control, a lot of this is about control over the balancing act that is every race car. So the calculation of every race car, which he is incredibly aware of at this point, is that the vehicle has to have the maximum amount of strength and the minimum amount of weight.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a battle that continues today in almost every racing venue, right? Well, or racing pursuit.
Sure, yeah. And the way that he did this, now this is even more impressive, because the time frame that we're talking about, the formula at Indianapolis, let's say.
Yeah.
By the formula, I mean, they allow certain, cubic inch displacements. They allow, so, you know, just like we hear about with modern F1 cars and any race series, really, you find that there's a formula involved, and you can't exceed or cheat that formula in any way. And, you can't cheat that formula. I mean, a lot of people bend the rules, as we've talked about with legends, I guess. You know, the automotive legends, the rule benders. But there's a formula for every race series, and you have to adhere to that so that you meet the class specifications, right? Everybody kind of understands what I'm talking about, I'm sure. But his engines, even in this incredibly just fast-changing world of Indianapolis, even just that one race, they were continually saying, like, okay, now engines have to be 183 cubic inches. Okay, now they're 191. Now they're 213. You know, they just kind of changed every year. There was something different. So he had to develop an all-new engine every single year. Yeah. And sometimes even more than that if he's going to race in other series or his racers were going to race in other series. But early on, in the early 1920s, his engines were the gold standard, really, for you know, for everything that the racers wanted. They wanted exactly what he was putting out. So his engines were the ones that were the sought after commodity here.
Right.
And I had mentioned early on in the last episode, then later I said I wanted to get to it as well. The thin design of the Miller car, because remember that blueprinted car that we talked about, and I think it was the end of the first episode.
Yes.
With all the crazy design characteristics. And the car body design that was going to be the standard for oval track racing for the next two decades, really. It was this extremely thin design. You don't get an appreciation for how thin these things were until you see one in person. And I'm talking about just the body. Now, I know the chassis and the wheels had a wide stance.
Like the wheelbase is wide, yeah.
The wheelbase is long, and then it had a wide track, I guess, maybe you'd say.
Yeah.
Like a width was wide. But the way I saw it described one time, and I'll just read this here it's from a different article, but it says, his cars were elegant as well as swift. As Preston Lerner wrote in a 2013 Automobile Magazine article about a convention of Miller cars in Milwaukee, the vehicle that won at Indy in 1926 is not a car at all. It's a strange way to say it. It's a razor blade suspended on four tall, skinny wheels. At its broadest point, the body is a mere 18 inches wide. Let that sink in for just a moment. At the very widest point, this race car body is 18 inches wide. That's not very wide at all. And yet, even with its puny 91.5 cubic inch engine, the car has been clocked at 171 miles per hour. Impressive.
Impressive.
But think about it. I mean, I'm looking at photos of, some of these old, mid-20s, Miller specials, I guess. You know, they all have different names, but this one, the one I'm looking at here is the Miller 91 boil valve special, and it has that extremely narrow body design. You know, I'm guessing that the driver's shoulders were wider than the body itself. You know, the design of the cockpit allows that to happen.
Yeah.
The extremely low door sills. You can't say door sills. There's no doors.
Right.
But it seems like the shoulders of the driver are going to be outside of the parameters of the body itself.
Mm-hmm.
Inside the wheels still, but it's just, it looks dangerous. It really does. But it looks cool. It looks fast. And that's the design standard that they maintained, for oval track racing in America, at least for at least 20 years.
Yeah. And let's also put in this point, which is important. Just because Harry Miller was a prolific engineering genius didn't mean that he would automatically dismiss other people's ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the 20s, when everybody is losing their minds over these Miller engines, he's also incorporating other design ideas from the best, the best racing manufacturers, you know. So he's taking some stuff from Bugatti as well, you know.
Sure.
If Mercedes has something he likes, he's going, oh, and that being Harry Miller, he's going, and he's having the light bulb moment, and he thinks for a few minutes or a few days, and then he goes, oh, but also this other tweak to it.
Yeah, here I'm going to make it with my own alloy, and I'm going mm-hmm. to make it lighter and better in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he's always refining and developing new things. And Ben, here's something that just kind of, you know, puts an exclamation point at the end of this whole thing for the 1920s, really. And we'll still talk about the 20s, but just to give you a sense of how, you know, dominating this guy was in the series, Miller almost overwhelmingly reigned at Indianapolis through the entire 1920s. Miller's won five Indianapolis 500s and never placed less than six cars in the top 10 throughout the 1920s.
So they were never not the most dominant player overall.
Yeah, and that made them the most sought after, right? So the mm-hmm. Miller name was really intertwining itself with oval track racing here in the United States, and it was a big deal at the time. I mean, this is a it's a lot of fun. it's a growing sport. It's something that, you know, it's dangerous, of course. You know, there's a lot of danger involved in these early, open wheel, open cockpit, you know, no seatbelt days, as you can imagine. So, it's an exciting sport and people want to be around it at this time. It's something that, is gripping the nation, really, maybe. That's the best way to say it, really. It's becoming part of the culture.
Yeah, part of the fabric of Americana, right?
Yeah.
And this reminds me, I think we can introduce another laundry list of some of Miller's records and inventions leading up to something that I think is really cool. So we're still in – we'll go through like some of the early 20s stuff. How's that sound?
Okay, let's do that.
All right. So word is out around the globe, around the racing world, and everybody has their eye on Miller. In summer of 1922, he began the design of a new engine in a car for the 122 cubic inch class. Mm-hmm. This new engine's only slightly changed. They have a two-valve hemispheric head and a five-main bearing crankshaft. The bodies of the 183s have been, you know, as we mentioned, very, very narrow and lightweight.
Yeah, maximum width, again, 18 inches. Mm-hmm.
But the 122 seemed even more narrow and lightweight.
Somehow.
Even though their maximum width was still 18 inches, they weighed slightly less, I believe, was one of the primary differences. So the 122 was the first – okay, here we go. It's another first. The 122 was the first pure racing car to be series produced.
Yeah. But not many of them were series produced, right?
No, it was a very small number.
Well, there were 15. Mm-hmm. But still, it's another one of these firsts, another one with the caveat, I guess, you know, first racing car to be series produced. And only 15, again, that's not a lot. Now, three of these cars were built for European Grand Prix use, and they're driven by, you know, European drivers, of course. Mm-hmm. And by 1923, 46% of the Indy starting field were Millers. And by 1925, 73%.
What?
This guy's a player in Indy, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I know it's not all about this one race, this one series, but this is where he's really making his mark in the world. He's you know, been elsewhere, and he's still – oh, by the way, he's still building boat engines. He's still building aircraft engines.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what's he going to do? Sleep like a rube?
No, and some of the bigger, and some of the winning, yeah, sleep like a rube. Yeah, some of the winning, or the winningest, maybe, if you want to say it,
sure.
Of the boat pilots, I guess, you know, the Unlimited series, you know, the Gar Underwoods, they're using, Miller engines in their vehicles. So, his name is really getting out there in just about every form of racing that you can imagine at this point. Again, a lot of firsts. And again, we're into a point in history where this formula keeps changing. And so, you know, he'll build like about, you know, 10 or 12 or 15 vehicles that conform to that formula. But then by the next year, it's completely different. So, you know, you got to completely change gears and create something brand new out of that workshop that he's got, or that amazing factory, I should say, not a workshop.
And he's continually setting records during this time, too.
Yeah, exactly. And so around, I think it was around 1924, here's another first. Miller designed and produced the 122, which is a front drive racing car in late 1924. Mm-hmm. Now, these were built using, again, here's the formula, the 91 cubic inch formula, which was enacted in 1926. And this is interesting. This author, and I don't know if we've mentioned this in this episode or not, but we're getting this information from the Miller-Offenhauser Historical Society. This author says that if Harry Miller had done nothing more in his highly creative career than to give the world a front-wheel drive car as a practical reality,
right,
that would have, you know, earned him a significant place in history. That alone.
That's a huge point. Okay, so some people may have noticed, may have felt a little slippery on the timeline there. The 122 front drive does come out in late 1924, mm-hmm. and only two are built before the 91 cubic inch formula comes in 26.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And this is really important because I know for some folks, as we said, the timeline can be kind of tricky here. This is your drill down trivia for the day, folks, friends and neighbors. The 122 front drive racing car made in late 1924, but at like to Scott's point about how things had to change so suddenly, they only built two before the 91 cubic inch formula comes into play in 26. And it is so difficult to describe to properly pay due diligence to the enormity, the bigness.
Yeah, I guess the
importance,
the weight, the historical weight,
the historical weight
of creating a front wheel drive car for racing,
especially because it worked.
Yeah, it worked. And the thing is that without the drive line that going through the cockpit, and that was also so dangerous for so many years.
Yeah,
the driver was able to sit like 9 inches lower than the comparable rear drive car. So this right away sets up a better center of gravity. You know, it's just a far better setup, a far superior setup. And then the Miller further reduced the height of the radiator.
Yeah.
And the result was this real low rakish car because they were able to kind of build around a different understructure. You know, like whatever was beneath the body was so dramatically different that they were able to make it even just a better looking car.
Yes, absolutely.
A more slippery car.
A more slippery car. That's a good way to say it. And this hits Detroit like a nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
They go crazy with the speculation, the research, the holy cow, we never thought this could, you know, be a reality, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at this point, only racing cars really were the ones at this point, you know,
right,
that were able to make do with this, and other, you know, there were passenger cars like the Cord L29, I think, was one that said they demonstrated the best possibility of front wheel drive, and there was a famous Citroen also, the Traction Avant of 1934 that proved that's much later, I guess, but that proved that, you know, front-wheel drive was definitely a reality. It was a practicality, maybe. It was something that could be done on a regular road and still be, you know, I guess functional, right? It was something that would be more practical for everyday use.
Yeah.
And funny that, you know, that came from racing, because you would think that, you know, they wouldn't be so concerned with practicality on the racetrack.
But,
right. but it came about because, you know, it allowed him to drop the driver down 9 inches and make it a more rakish design and more streamlined and therefore faster through the air. I mean, it all makes sense, really, when you think about it that way.
It all makes sense. And we are going to pause for a word from our sponsor. Be warned, when we return, we'll be in the middle of the Roaring Twenties.
And we're back, and we're right in the middle of the 1920s, as you said, Ben. And at this point, this guy is a wealthy, wealthy man.
I mean, he's doing so well.
He is. He's you know, making just a pile of money. He's got friendships of with businessmen, sports figures, Hollywood stars. He's hobnobbing with the elite.
He has a ranch as well.
And I would guess that this guy, you know, it probably made him a little bit uncomfortable, really. I mean, knowing his character, you know, we've read about how he was kind of a shy guy. He didn't really talk to a lot of people outside of, you know, engineers and other people that were
right.
designers or race car drivers.
Well, unless they wanted to talk about racing and engines.
Yeah, I guess so. And, you know, I would guess that, sure, businessmen would want to do that. Sports figures, I mean, does that include drivers of the day? I would guess it would.
Yeah.
Hollywood stars, maybe not so much. But, you know, Hollywood stars have a lot of money to throw around, too. And I bet a lot of them were into racing. So maybe they had some things to talk about. So that's maybe what's going on here. But I feel that maybe, though, he was kind of the shy guy at the party, you know?
Yeah, I just
feel that's probably the way it was. But anyways, of course, the formula has changed again for 1926, and he's got a new engine, new race car.
But the more things change, the more they stay the same, because every single piece of the component, except for proprietary parts that he cannot legally create himself, that's all that was stopping him, was that it would be illegal to do so. All these were designed and built all over again just for the 91. This was built in rear drive series production with completion of 9 cars, so not too many. And then 10 Miller 91 front drives were built, and they each had their own design. So these were each in some way a variation on the theme.
And just to give you an idea of what this cost. So in 1926,
and
the idea was, and they said, you know, if you wanted to win, you had to buy a Miller. That way, there was no way around it. You have to have a Miller car.
If you can afford it.
Yeah, if you can afford it. Now, a factory rear drive car was something. Now, this is rear drive. around $10,000, and that's in 1926. And if you to draw that out to 2017, that's about $140,000.
Yeah, and a front drive car would cost you $15,000.
Yeah,
15 large in 1926 dollars, and that works out to about $206,000 today.
Yeah. Yep, exactly right. So that was it was pretty expensive, and we're talking about a time frame between what, 1926 and 1929,
yeah.
I think, right around there. And that's about the price range that you would pay. But just to give you an idea of how many people did want to win and did buy Millers, you know, in that time frame that I mentioned, those 3 years, 26 to 29, between 71% and 85% of the Indy starting field were Millers at this point. So, man, it was a tough competition because everybody had these winning cars, really.
Mm-hmm.
So it came down to driver skill.
Right, yeah.
And tuning, of course.
Driver skill, tuning, there are a couple different factors there.
Yeah, and then as a result of this, you know, the success on the track, there were boat owners that approached Miller to produce, you know, racing engines for their sport boats. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course, he created marine versions of his 122 and 91 cubic inch car engines. And then he had new designs that came out for these boats, the 310 cubic inch straight eights and a 620 cubic inch V16. That he created for boat racing as well. And I think those are the ones that Garwood would use. I think those were the giant engines that you would see in those Garwood power boats. But here's the thing. You know, the looks and the durability and the quality of these Miller cars, they, you know, everything that led them to be so successful also led to their demise because, you know, the Miller chassis and body, I guess, was something that every race car kind of dreamed about. You know, they would think like, well, if I could only get a Miller, I'd be up at the front of the field. And
right.
as we saw, a lot of the Indy racers did that. But the problem was later on that his cars were then taken, the ones that he had designed and built, they
right.
were eventually taken back to, you know, the smaller shops, and they were re-engineered and designed in a different way. So they were, you know, the original identity, I guess, was lost. They
right.
weren't preserved as a Miller original, really.
Right, because people would like the design aesthetic. People like the exterior so much that they would say, well, I want it to look like that, but I want to try a couple of other things.
Yeah.
And so they would get into the guts of it.
Yeah, and the problem with that is it dilutes the brand, right?
Right.
Because later, you know, you're going to buy a Miller car and you buy one that somebody has kind of messed around with, has changed or altered in some way, and you're not really getting the original. You're not getting what you had thought you were getting, maybe. So, you know, again, sometimes it's tough to – you don't mess with the original, maybe.
Right. It's a tall order.
Ask Coca-Cola. They know that. All right. So,
oh, man.
Here's the thing. Okay. So we're up to the late 1920s. And
there's a reason we stop here.
Yeah. There's actually some good advice here.
Yes. Okay. I agree with you, Scott. All right. So – we're leading up to an unfortunate period in U.S. history, the crash of 1929, which ushers in one of the most difficult economic eras since the founding of this nation.
Yeah,
right?
But apparently he had good people around him.
Yes, because Harry Miller's associates gave him some advice and told him to retire from his business.
Yeah, and this is just weeks before the crash in 1929.
They smelled it in the wind.
Well, yeah, sure. I think a lot of people had, and they said, "You got to get out. You got to pull out, or else you're going to be left with nothing."
Yeah,
and he did that. He did retire, and he retired with he also had a $60,000 retainer from Cord and the sale of his businesses for about $150,000, which allowed him this, again, to continue to live this luxurious lifestyle.
Right. And if we do the calculation, $150,000, not even counting the $60,000 retainer, $150,000 in 1929 has the same buying power as $2.13 million.
Not bad. So he could retire on that amount of money at that time. And that's exactly what he did. But the problem was, well, you know what the problem was. This guy has an active mind.
He can't sleep.
He can't turn it off. He can't stop, you know, the ideas, the thoughts. So the problem is that he decides that in 1930 he's going to set up a new engineering business, which is just awful timing. I mean, he knows what's going on. He's setting up a new engineering business.
And hired the rest of the – he was like, guys, let's get the band back together. And he hired the rest of his old staff back.
Well, that's what he did. Yeah, and it's crazy. But the thing is – it's not the world of the 1920s that he was thinking it was. It's totally changed. He didn't have the thought that we're looking at something brand new here, so a new America.
We've moved from the Gilded Age to the age of Steinbeck.
Yeah. And the problem was, the biggest problem with this was, is that, you know, he's building these high dollar racing machines,
and there's no one to buy them.
Yeah, no one can afford them. So big problem. And you know, he kind of like he hangs on for a little while, a few years, but in 1933, Harry Miller has to declare bankruptcy,
which is a crying shame, because at the start of the same decade, a prominent race car owner says, you know, I'll try one of these Miller four-cylinder, 151 cubic inch marine engines in my race car.
Yeah.
And it's bonkers, man. It's bananas.
Yep.
It's successful beyond anything anyone was expecting, because they thought it would be great, but they didn't think it would be this great. The prototype established a new international speed record. They asked Miller to design a race car version, and he developed an economy racing engine for the hard times. He said, "Okay, we'll try to do something that gets bang and considers buck."
And Ben, we're skipping over the most important part of this car.
Ah, yes,
this is another first. Mm-hmm. This is the first worthwhile, again, there's the caveat, the first worthwhile four-wheel drive racing car design, and that was his brainchild. It was his idea. As they said, you know, his friends had said, you know, Harry Miller's a guy that would gamble his last dollar on the drawing board, and that's kind of what he did with this. I mean, we know the time frame we're in, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he knows what's happening, as we said. He knows this crash is going on, but he just doesn't understand the long-term effects and how long this is going to last. And so he designs this four-wheel drive race car in late 1931. They said it was a gloomy fall, you know, of 1931 when he decided this. And his creditors were, you know, at the time they were kind of swarming around his business saying, like, you know,
right. Is
this really the time to be investing all this money? You know, we're going to call in some of these bills. You're going to have to pay us. But the car itself was really remarkable. It was extrapolated from the front wheel drives of the 1920s that he created, and the four wheel drives had the same Dedeon drive system at both the front and the rear, and there was a new 308 cubic inch twin cam V8 along with, you know, this complete new drive system, and there were two cars that were completed at a cost of more than $30,000 at the time. Mm-hmm. And these cars, unfortunately, were not totally successful. Now, both of these, you know, the problems, I guess, were due to bad luck and design flaws, and at Indy and just about everywhere else in the 1930s. But they really didn't give the opportunity to display what they were capable of, because again, these are works in progress, right? They
right.
could be refined. But in 1934, one of these cars was raced at the Grand Prix of Tripoli, and then in the Avis Grand Prix, and that's the one in Berlin that we talked about, where the exploding motor
yeah.
almost caused the engine parts, or car parts really, to take out Hitler,
mm-hmm.
who was in the viewing stands. So the other car, I think, eventually was just raced on in hill climbs before it was finally retired. But again, they just didn't have the right timing down. They just weren't in the right spot at the right time, I guess, maybe.
Right. And it was kind of – also there was a rush to it too, because I think they still needed to refine the design. But that's why a lot of historians believe that the four-wheel drive cars were the cars that really – sealed the deal on bankruptcy.
Yeah, and then with the bankruptcy, you know, something good came out of this, really. Something mm-hmm. really good came out of this. Now, a guy by the name of Fred Offenhauser, and we've mentioned that, you know, this information is coming from the Miller Offenhauser Historical Society.
Yes.
And Fred Offenhauser plays big into this, because he was Miller's shop foreman and his chief machinist.
Yeah.
When he was working, for Harry Miller at the
Pretty
time.
Pretty much one of his closest friends.
And when these assets were sold at auction, this guy, Fred Offenhauser, picked up the entire engine design and continued to produce it and refine it as the decades progressed.
Right.
And this design is what became what they called the Indomitable Offie, which is probably the most victorious racing engine of all time, because this guy bought this engine design in 1933. And do you know that Offie engines, or Offenhauser engines, mm-hmm. were run at Indianapolis through the 1970s. So let's just say 1980, all the way up until 1980. That's 50 years of Offenhauser engines at Indy, and that's based on, you know, the Harry Miller designs that are going back another 10 years.
Yeah, and of course, this would be the number one pick to inherit and continue this legacy. Offenhauser is probably, out of everyone else in the world, the person most qualified to understand what Miller was aiming for
yep.
and where it could go. Now, Scott, before we go into the next turn here.
Oh, there's an interesting character in the next turn as well.
Right. So scoot up to your edge of your seats, and we'll be back after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back, and Ben, we just had kind of teased that there's a really interesting character coming after this break here.
Oh, buddy.
This is a big one, right? We've talked about this guy in the past, and I'm glad these two got together, really. This is an interesting story. And more on this in another Car Stuff podcast, but Preston Tucker sought out Miller in the early 1930s. In fact, it was around 1935, so this is post-bankruptcy.
Yep.
And pre-Tucker Automobile Company.
Yes, and Tucker essentially says, you know, look, I'm a master salesman. I feel that a stock block engine and a modern independently sprung chassis might have a chance to win here.
That's probably exactly what he sounded like when he said it, I'm sure.
You could design it.
Yeah, but the idea, well, case, of course, Miller said, you know what, I think you're right. I think we can make something to work here.
And he said, I have the connects.
Yeah.
Tucker said, I have the connections in Detroit. It's where we can get in the room to pitch this, and if I can pitch it and you can build it, we know they'll buy it.
And not only that, but Preston Tucker was an incredible salesman, right? I mean, he had the gift of gab. He could talk anybody into anything, really. So, and he did that, but he presented his idea to Edsel Ford. And they said, well, you know, Edsel Ford said, you know, I'm all on board with this. I think that's something we should do. But the problem was that, you know, they wanted these ready, or Edsel Ford wanted these ready by the end of February in 1935. And this deal was struck for the construction of 10 cars, right? So no way they're going to get 10 cars done in that time frame.
Oh, I have the calculation for you, too, if you're interested.
Okay, what's that?
Let's go by the numbers.
Okay.
All right, so let's go on the high end, 6,500 man hours to make one car.
Okay,
right?
Sure.
That's the calculation we start with.
Yeah.
So 6,500 hours would equal about 270 days. And 270 days, or on the high end, 270.8, if you like, that equals 8.9 months.
Okay.
So that's...
They've got
one car.
They've got less than 3 months to create 10 cars. Yeah, to create 10 race cars for Ford Motor Company.
And to test them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. And to test them, and there's just no chance, right? There's no way that they're going to get this done. But somehow, they got these cars developed and built within that time frame. Now, just to give you a little bit of a background, I guess, the $75,000 doesn't sound like a whole lot of money, but that was $1.3 million in 2017 funds. So it was a significant amount of money. Again, you're talking about race cars, though, so maybe not that much money.
Well, we're also talking about the Great Depression.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Okay, that's the other thing. Ford had the money to spend $1.3 million equivalent in the middle of the 1930s when not a lot of other people did. I mean,
no.
Individuals weren't coming to them with this type of idea. So, you know, they kind of had to take this deal when it came around. But the inevitable happened during the race. Now, the cars were rushed to be put together, of course, as we said. And of course, you know, there was the situation at the shop was what they called one of unrelieved panic. Now,
right.
I can't imagine trying to build race cars for Ford Motor Company in a situation where you're in this unrelieved panic situation.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Can you imagine? It was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, round the clock, you know, just all the way from the end of February until the race day, really. Only four cars qualified for the race, and all of those four cars retired early for the exact same reason. There was a seized steering gearbox that overheated because of its proximity to the exhaust. So it's just a design flaw that they could have easily, remedied.
If they just were able to practice and experiment with it a little.
They had no time for testing at all, so they couldn't really put these things through the ringer and figure out what was wrong. But that's something that could have completely saved the reputation of Harry Miller,
mm-hmm.
of course, Preston Tucker along with him,
right.
and the Ford Motor Company, because Edsel had set up this deal. But here's the funny thing, and I find this funny because of the character involved.
Oh, yes. Who should rear his brilliant, absolutely insane head in our story but the man himself?
Yep. Henry Ford. So Henry Ford, of course, you know, the father of Edsel Ford.
Loses his mind.
He lost his mind because, and, you know, you think he would understand the situation. Like, it was a rush situation and, you know, and look at it, you know, with a calculated, you know, in a calculated manner, I guess, but he didn't. He was embarrassed, right?
Yeah.
So Henry Ford himself ordered these 10 cars hauled away and just to be kind of like put out of sight for about a decade.
He's like, hide them.
Yeah, just hide these cars. We want these put away. Now,
because it made Ford look bad in racing.
Yeah, well, it dealt a serious blow to the Ford image and, of course, to Harry Miller's image. So he became kind of the fall guy. Of course, Harry Miller became the fall guy for what really shouldn't have ever happened.
I mean, scapegoat.
Yeah, this guy had made some of the most beautiful racing cars of this decade and the most successful, and he was put in a bad situation. And it just didn't work out. I mean, it made things worse, I guess. And it kind of led the way for the way Harry's future would end up, I guess, maybe. It's kind of like a bad omen, really, of what's to come.
Yeah.
So after this Miller Ford debacle, as they call it, Miller formed a business venture with, a guy named, he was an automotive stylist. This guy's name is Tom Hibbard.
Mm-hmm.
And his design or his idea was to build a trim speedster based, Ford V8 chassis that was shortened. And again, this would use the 91 cubic inch straight eight that they had engineered. It was a mid-engine design and it was a fully independently sprung sports car, but nothing came out of this dream. It never really happens.
And after that business venture goes up in smoke in 1937, Miller has a returning client, a person named Ira Vail, who had placed one of the initial engine orders for a straight eight engine. And this time, Vail says, I want to commission the design and construction of some new four-cylinder machines to compete against that old pre-World War I technology. And that's what was, at the time, running the game on the dirt tracks in Indianapolis. So Miller designs a lightweight aero engine, deep chassis members, independent suspension, and here we go. Still another first. Disc yep. brakes.
All the way in 1937. Disc brakes. So another Miller first. Disc brakes on a race car, right?
Yeah, bet you're mad now, listeners, when you think back all those times you had to mess around with drum brakes.
That's right. And really, Ben, this car ended up becoming like a testbed showcase for an oil and lubrication company. Because shortly after Miller started construction of those cars, the Gulf Oil Company approached him and said they want to buy out the project. So they decided that they were going to use these vehicles with current gas and lubricants and kind of show what their product could do on the track, really. And these race cars were completed, but, you know, testing and attempts at qualifying kind of showed that these things had cooling problems. So that was something,
right,
you know, that they just decided that there was nothing they could do with them. They disposed of the cars, and they were just never raced again. Isn't that strange to think they just got rid of the project? Like, it was
yes.
a special Harry Miller project. They decided, well, we're just going to scrap the whole thing.
Well, they're a very large company, you know.
I guess so.
A program was launched immediately after that, and people were looking to construct a Grand Prix-worthy car using a team of the best in the business. This would be a cost-is-no-object kind of race car, so no worrying about economy for Mr. Miller. But at this point, he's aging, his health is flagging, and he said, I'm going to give it one more go. This was to be a 180 cubic inch six-cylinder supercharged four-wheel drive mid-engine independently sprung disc-braked technical masterpiece, right?
Yeah, it's impressive.
It's the engine was the world's first to have over square bore and stroke dimensions.
Over square. Now,
yeah.
That's something I need to talk about because
yeah.
over square, when you describe something as over square, someone might scratch their head and say, what does that mean? It just means basically it's a short stroke engine. So the cylinder bore is greater than the diameter, I should say, is greater than the stroke length. So
mm-hmm.
it's more capable, I guess, of higher RPMs. So that's the benefit here in racing. Higher RPM engine, short stroke engine.
Yeah, this car has massive, immense, gigantic potential if it's given time to be properly developed, which, of course, it is not. This very complicated car was rushed to completion, and it failed to qualify for the 1938 Indy.
Yeah, And there were three cars, actually. They were completed for 1939 as well. And one of these cars crashed and burned dramatically, as they say. One was withdrawn, and the other one failed to complete the race at all. So not very successful toward the end of the career. That's a real shame, because this program had potential again. You know, with cost no object, the best of the best, kind of a dream team situation.
Right.
And it just didn't work out. Maybe it's because Miller didn't have complete control. He wasn't the only one.
That's part of it, too, because, we get, just like the idea of the explosion in Berlin, we have to wonder how history could have worked out differently. Because, let's be honest, he's a living legend, and if he just decided to not plunge wholeheartedly, not go all in to building a car in what is an unrealistic time frame, right? Then he probably could have just been a consultant.
Go out on top. That's what you're saying, right? And this last one, this one that we were just talking about there, I should point out that was also a Gulf project. And the Gulf honeymoon, I guess if you want to call it that, had kind of dissolved at this point. So, it's kind of like an abrupt downfall, I guess, to this guy's career, really. And it's sad to see. At one point we're getting really towards the end, but, his reputation has kind of is dwindled a little bit, which is sad because his cars, his engines, his just
– instrumental.
Yeah. He was just such a dominant force in this arena for so long. It's sad to see this happen, but I never saw any notes on this really, but it seems like his marriage might have ended around the same time as well. And I'm not entirely sure, but here's the way it's described, and you tell me what you think.
Right.
So Harry moved by himself, and his wife returned to California. So he moved by himself back to Indianapolis, where he engaged in various aircraft projects involving Preston Tucker. Now, all this ended badly, and a year later, Miller moved to Detroit. He set up a small business making text fixtures and tools, and he spent the last 2 years of his life in just awful shape, just terrible condition.
Yeah, impoverished.
Yeah, exactly. And he spent, it's a sad thing for a guy that had been on top at one point, right? I mean, he's not the character that he used to be. He's not the same man that he used to be. He's dwindling here. And at age 65, which is relatively young still, that's not that old. Yeah. Having suffered, I think he had suffered with diabetes, and this is the worst. He acquired something they called facial cancer. Mm-hmm. That's terrible. But he knew the end was near. And in 1943, he suffered a fatal heart attack and died on May 3rd. And his ashes were interred in Los Angeles with very little fanfare. And as I say, it was a sad passing for a flawed but vital man. Now, what a precipitous fall for him, right? I mean, he was on top. He was rubbing shoulders with the elite, the sports stars of the day, the ultra wealthy businessmen and women, and the Hollywood elite. Mm-hmm. And now here it is. Just really, it's not many years later. Maybe 15 years later. He's living this horrible life, with he's got cancer, he's got diabetes, his heart is failing, his businesses are falling apart. He made these bad deals at the end of his career. I would typically like to end on a happy note, but this isn't one. This isn't a good ending for this guy.
Not particularly.
No, it's a sad ending.
Yes, Scott, you are right. Unfortunately, it's a sad ending, but there are numerous silver linings to this. And one thing that's fascinating here is toward the end, as things draw nigh and the curtain begins to close, I feel like there's an untold story in this section, because what happened between him and his wife and the relationship of great minds like Tucker and Miller working on this stuff that they can't seem to get to click. Mm-hmm. And they, they worked together on and off until Miller passed away. And they must have actually been friends because Tucker helped Miller's widow pay for the funeral costs.
Yeah, and at that time, now if I'm remembering this correctly, weren't they working on that combat car that Tucker had decided that he wanted to build?
Yes.
It was kind of a pet project for Tucker with a turret on the top, and he had some kind of crazy ability to shoot and drive at the same time, which was something that was something that I think the tanks of the day couldn't do. I think that was it. I'm stretching the limits of my memory here.
And he took Miller took some of the stuff, some of the designs from the Tucker combat car or concepts from it to American Bantam, and he got involved with the development of the first Jeep. And then also another interesting tie in here, it was while Miller and Tucker were working together that I think it was through them that Tucker met the chief mechanic John Eddy Offutt, who would later help him build the first prototype of the 48 Tucker.
Oh, well, that's good then. So that relationship, that partnership, led them to cross paths with even other characters that became important in his story later on as well. Preston Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it opened a lot of doors for a lot of people. Maybe that's the way to put it.
Absolutely.
Because look at his involvement with just developing carburetors and then. Placing boat engines into these small craft, mm-hmm. that Ollie Evinrude then saw and decided to patent this, and he's got his hands in so many things that his legacy is one of great success. I mean, tremendous mm-hmm. success for decades and decades. His name will always be tied with racing, especially American oval track racing. But there's so many other fields that this reaches into, he's played such a huge part. So even though we said that we kind of ended on a sad note, I guess, with the man himself,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes that happens. I mean, sometimes the person themselves has a sad or a tragic ending, but their legacy is one of tremendous accomplishment, of great success.
Sometimes the people who do the most for society end up being the least appreciated, unfortunately.
Yeah, and sometimes even later on, they're recognized for their achievements,
Yeah, posthumously.
Yeah.
I mean, we're a species who killed a guy for saying that the Earth goes around the sun.
Yeah, I guess. And, the lucky thing is that, the lucky thing for Miller, I guess, is that, there were times in his life when he was on top. He was recognized while he was alive. He's able to enjoy, that life, I guess, that he had built for himself and his wife. But it just didn't end so well for him at the very, very, very end.
And at the risk of sounding corny, is he really gone? Not if you're a race fan, because so much of what he did became inherent DNA in so many racing vehicles, from the design to engine considerations. It's remarkable how profoundly one individual, a single person, was able to affect this billion-dollar industry, influence it. I would say in many ways set the course. And this legacy lasts today. It's not going away. If you have friends who are big racing fans and they don't know about Harry Miller.
Oh, they know.
They have to.
They know. And they probably know about the Miller-Offenhauser connection,
yes.
The way that they're involved. And I'm sure that they know most of the story, and they know most of the firsts as well. He's a big name. He's someone that people know. If you're in the know in the racing world, you know about Harry Miller.
And if you'd like to check back on some of our previous episodes that we mentioned regarding racing or our Legends series that we alluded to, then do visit our website, carstuffshow.com, where you can check out every audio episode we've ever done. And oh, brother.
Yeah.
There are a lot.
There are a lot.
There are a lot.
We're getting towards, I think we've got to be getting close to 800 now.
No way.
We have to be.
Oh, man. Do we get anything?
I don't think so.
We don't get like a car?
No. No, balloons don't fall from the ceiling or anything like
there's
that.
There's no confetti.
No. I think here's what happens. I think the 800th episode happens, which, that may be months from now. I don't know where we are exactly in the frame of things. But here's what usually happens. We talk about it for a while. We say we're going to do a special episode
right.
for that milestone achievement. And then the thing passes, and we say, oh, by the way, you know, remember 2 weeks ago when we did the episode on whatever this was, X, Y, and Z?
Right, right.
That was our 800th. That's how it works. It just happens.
Well, we're not a show about counting, Scott. We're a show about cars.
We're not math geniuses, okay?
Not so, a math doctor whatever. Not a numbers surgeon.
It's usually kind of like, you know, the muted trumpet moment, you know, like when it's over. It's already happened.
Let's see. I think we can keep Dylan's name from the previous iteration or the earlier part of this series, and we'll just stick with Twin Cam.
Twin Cam? Sure.
Sure. Unless you want to say 48, that's good. Oh. Talk about numbers.
Yeah.
All right. Well, when you meet our super producer, Dylan, just call him 48.
I'll be confused. Maybe we can get him a jersey with the number 48 on it.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah.
See? That's why you're the smart one here.
No, thanks. Well, you know, I'm not a math doctor, but I do play one on this podcast.
Oh, where's that trumpet?
I know. Oh. It's an old line, but I think I kind of made it work.
Yeah,
for the situation.
You made it your own.
Yeah,
you
I
know,
did. I really
you
did.
Innovated, just like Miller.
Oh, I'm always I lay awake at night thinking of closing clever lines like that, you know?
Don't worry, I was very inordinately proud of making up the phrase math doctor.
And I used it freely. I mean, you said the other one was, what?
Number surgeon?
Yeah, number surgeon. That's a good one.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I'm going to think about it later. If you have a favorite between those two, recommend it to us. We obviously would welcome any help. But don't say mathematician. That's not as fun.
That's real.
That's a real thing.
I think it's real.
Oh, my gosh. Is there a math doctor somewhere listening who's going to write in?
Yeah, it's a real thing, jackasses.
Yeah, right? Sincerely, Alfred Knopfwitz, D-O-M. Doctor of math?
I guess so, yeah.
So this concludes today's episode in this series, but not our show, which brings me to an important point. We will be back next week. In the meantime, if you are given to social media shenanigans, feel free to swing by our Facebook and Twitter page where we are CarStuff HSW. You can see all sorts of things that may or may not make it to the air, including stuff from listeners just like you. And speaking of you, you are the source of our best ideas and suggestions for upcoming shows. We'd love to hear from you. You can drop a line on the Twitter or Facebook, or if you think that stuff is a bunch of tomfoolery and malarkey, we totally get it. You can write to us directly. We are
CarStuff at HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.